Savvy regards to the staff of student teachers at Namata, as well as Sally regards to visitors and guests to the site. This is the main professor with the introductory talk for Course 12, Ideosophy. I'm especially pleased to welcome you to this new course, which has taken the place of contra-violence that originally occupied that position in the courses, the 12th and final course, which interfaces with the three vocations, forming a close interface with Course 13, or the vocation in the humanities. So, in keeping with my usual protocols and procedures, this intro talk will be embedded in the course landing page, so everyone who comes by can listen to it if they care to do so. As usual, of course, the units for the course, which include talk and text, which you find listed in the curriculum panel, will be available to staff only. I'm going to start out by telling you about something that I just did at the moment that I sat down to record this talk. I went into a search machine on the internet and I put in ideosophy. Now, is it ideosophy or ideosophy? Is it ideology or ideology? I don't know if there is a preferred pronunciation. You'll probably see me or hear me waver back and forth from one to the other from time to time. But needless to say, having in my own little bubble of reality or super reality coined the term ideosophy some time ago, I think I wrote it down for the first time when I started a page on metahistory.org, but that would be going back quite a ways, maybe a year and a half ago. I don't know. Anyway, I did not assume at the moment that I invented the word, that I was the first to introduce the word. So today, just this moment, I decided to go take a look on the internet to see if that word can be found. And I'll just tell you what came up. Not much. And I can tell you that the search engine spiders had a little difficulty in handling that term. I was asked if I meant echosophy or ecosophy, if that's a word. And I was asked, of course, if I meant ideology. But no, I meant ideosophy. And it so happens that the word comes up on a site called Impossible Machine. This is a website. And the page that comes up is titled Intellectual Themes. And I will read you the display on the page. It's a black background with some writing in a chalkboard as the background image. The text is in white and it says, Intellectual Themes, Book 1, Sophology and Ideosophy, an alternative to metempsychosis is to generate pure philosophy using neology. This is the nascent domain of sophology or ideosophy. Words are combined for unique meanings which reflect the higher orders of nature, mind, systems, language, etc. This is on the hardcore side of philosophy, but also has a whimsical side. Disciplines which can be considered part of sophology include neology of logical semantics, sophistry, reality semantics, metaphysical epistemology, semiotics, etc. So that is one single page, one single screen that comes up on the internet when you search for the word ideosophy. What I can relate to in that sparse and terse layout or profile, which speaks equally of sophology and ideosophy and appears to combine them as a single unit, what I can relate to there is the statement, an alternative to metempsychosis is to generate pure philosophy using neology. Well, I certainly like the idea of an alternative to metempsychosis, whatever that is. I suppose it's some cousin of metaphysics. Those of you who followed me for a while will certainly know that I entirely reject metaphysics and consider it to be extraneous, superfluous, and absurd. The only metaphysics you'll find in association with Planetary Tantra and the courses in Nemata are the presumed metaphysical propositions of Maya Vada Vedanta. So, great, we're not going to do any metaphysics, we're not going to truck with metaphysics when we get into ideosophy. So it's not a metaphysical system, but neither is it, to my mind, a philosophical system. The website says here that it's an alternative way to generate pure philosophy using neology. Okay, I would reject the first part of the phrase. I'm not trying to generate pure philosophy here. Although, it must always be borne in mind that the word philosophy means love of Sophia. So in that sense, I am always generating philosophy. But really, set that aside, what really fits here in this profile is the phrase using neology. So to a certain extent, I do just that. And you know, I have done that throughout my work. In fact, I used to have a really, really bad habit of overusing neology. That is to say, overworking the play of words and inventing too many words. Way, way too many neologisms. For instance, a neologism that I invented was self-X. This was in the context of my particular anomalous variant of astrology that I was teaching along with the alchemy course in the 80s. So I said everyone has their self-X. Your self-X is your program of self-explanation. So I introduced that to my students. It got into their jargon, and it reached the point where a moment might occur in the course of a conversation when someone was out like downtown off the plaza having coffee, this is in Santa Fe, a couple of my students chatting and one of them would be getting on a rift and the other one would hold up his hand and say, now that's your self-ex speaking. You're talking about your self-ex. Self-ex means the legitimate or illegitimate explanation of where you're coming from in any context or for any purpose or motive. So, you know, I invented words like self-ex. That's not too bad. It's kind of snappy. It stands up. I invented the word simplific. And in the course, which is now being excerpted in course one of Guyan Alchemy. In the original course from Santa Fe, I had introduced a considerable number of awkward neologisms. So I've been working at this business of neology, making up new terms, for quite a while. I can happily inform you, though, that there are not a lot of new terms in idiosophy. There are some terms that may be unfamiliar to you. You may not yet have gotten on to the word or cottoned on to the word. It's an old expression which I find charming. You may not have yet cottoned on to the term ethnogenesis, not to be confused with entheogenesis. The two prefixes, ethno and entheo, are easily confounded. Entheo refers to psychonauts and dimensions of the psychonautic and shamanic experience. Ethno refers to racial groups and racial stereotypes. So you may not quite be familiar or comfortable with that word yet. But by and large, apart from some specific terms that you are getting to know, I really don't indulge in neology in this course. Nevertheless, as I say in the opening lines of the landing page, you are going to be receiving this course and the units in this course in a rather idiosyncratic way, which is formally distinct from the language and style of the other courses. And I explain how that is so toward the end of the landing page. Over the years, as I've pondered on philosophy and metaphysics and noetics and occultism and a whole range of arcane subjects, it's been clear to me that it is necessary at times to invent new words, to introduce neologisms. And you could say that ideosophy is a genuine neologism originating from yours truly. But really, more importantly, is the originality of the ideas and the use of specific terms in a precise and consistent way. You see, if you look at the terms or themes and issues that come under the genre of ideology, you'll find some of them listed here in the first paragraph, actually. Among the topics and issues comprised in the humanities, some belong specifically to the genre of ideology, namely the race romantic ethos, that's my term, racial humanism, that's not my term, Guyan ethics, my term, contraviolence, yes, the moral sense, that's not my term, the JQ, which I would prefer to designate as the JP, well, that is certainly on the minds and tongues of multitudes of tads in the world today. Ethnogenesis, not my term, comes from Lev Gumilev. Eritocracy, now is that my term? Well, go find out for yourself. Put it in a search engine and see if it comes up. Eritocracy simply means the leadership of a people or nation by the best people, by the most accomplished, excellent, noble, and honorable people of that nation. That would be an eritocracy. Finally, historical avatars. Well, that's not my invention. That's a subject that has been discussed widely in connection with you-know-who, Savitri Devi, who was associated with you-know-who of the 12-year Reich, has written extensively on this idea of historical avatars. So I don't have a monopoly, strict monopoly, on some of these terms, but my treatment of them, well, I'm going to say, I'm going to make this pretentious claim, that in the way I treat them, the way I spin them, and the syntax I use to develop these topics, I do have almost a virtual monopoly. And those of you who come to NEMATA to join the staff, or who just come as a guest to see what you can get from it by browsing around the campus, would benefit from knowing that. You would benefit from knowing that the material at your disposal is unique to this site. I don't know anyone talking about the moral sense of Shaftesbury today. You hear a lot of chatter and discussion and debate about the problem of the so-called Enlightenment liberal and the repercussions and ramifications of liberalism today. It's generally accepted, and I think it's true and evidentially founded, that liberalism and the liberal philosophy of social order and politics emerged during the period of the Enlightenment, which is centered around 1650. So the moral sense is not my term, comes from Shaftesbury, but the way I handle it is uniquely mine. Likewise, for ethnogenesis, I shall be taking the work of Lev Gumilev and parlay it into some rather novel iterations. The term racial humanism is not mine, but I certainly intend to put my stamp on it for the ages, and it will be mine by the time the fat lady sings. Come to think of it, I'm not exactly sure when this term racial humanism popped up, you know. It may be drifting around. You know, after all, words in language are rather like pieces of currency in commerce, you know, like dollars and cents. Money that passes by your hands doesn't really belong to anyone. So when you have $20 in your pocket, it really doesn't belong to you. It's just available for your use. So it's the same with words, yet occasionally a word or phrase will achieve high definition due to the intention that an individual puts behind it. That's certainly the case for racial humanism. Not sure when it came to mind, but certainly it was during the last year, since I had the occasion to read two books by a French social historian, I would call him, a professor at the Sorbonne, who teaches contemporary history, and his name is Johann Chapoutot, Chapoutot. And Chapoutot is actually quite young and appears to be something of a wunderkind in the realm of French academia. So he wrote a book called The Law of Blood, thinking and acting as a Nazi. There, I said it, the dreaded N-word. And the purpose of this book is certainly not to endorse or promote Nazi ideology or the Nazi code of ethics. The purpose of the book he undertook as an historian was to lay out what the Nazis thought and what was contained in their ideology as they saw it on their own terms. You know, so the book is largely not critical of Nazi ideology. And as a matter of fact, I don't know whether it was his intention or not, but Chapoutot really lays it out there, and it's quite stunning to read in great depth and detail what the preeminent Nazi thinkers and political leaders of the Reich actually thought and believed, and what motivated them, and what was their worldview. It's really, really, really astonishing to read. He also wrote another book called Greeks, Romans, Germans, How the Nazis Usurped Europe's Classical Past. And it may have been a passage in that book that brought to my mind the term racial humanism, because he says on page 111, speaking of the foundations of National Socialism and the ideology as defined by a particular individual named Baumler, he said there was clearly a very real desire at work to define what seems to us to be a blatant oxymoron, a Nazi humanism. Well, imagine that. In fact, the subtitle of this chapter is National Socialism as Humanism. So there you go. And possibly somewhere in the reading of one of these books, one or the other of these books, the notion and concept of racial humanism came into definition for me. It showed up on the horizon, and I intend to do the best I can with that concept. So these topics and issues I list in the first paragraph could be included in the genre of the humanities. But there's one particular problem that I had to face, a challenge, one of those challenges of the kind that comes up in the work that I do as a self-educated freelance teacher. I end up always, I tell you, it gets boring and tiresome at times, but end up always as defining my own problems and then going out and trying to solve them. I end up as setting my own challenges. I don't get my challenges and problems set for me by anybody else. And sometimes it takes a while, sometimes it takes years before these challenges and problems that are unique to my way of operating will come into definition. But as I wrote here on the course landing page, looking over the 12 courses and the 3 vocations over the last year since the school's been in operation, you might well have pondered, as I did, where does Gnostic instruction on building the mythogen fit into Nemeta? In what genre? Conforming to what line of studies? Well, certainly you could say it shows up here and there in various places. But I sensed strongly that it needed its own proper locale. and I couldn't find it by scanning the 12 courses or three vocations or the remaining items in the curriculum of Nemata. And as I was not particularly satisfied with Course 12 operating under the title of Contraviolence, I decided to substitute Ideosophy in its place. Ideosophy is the frame of ethical and ideological parameters required to establish and actualize the mythogen specific to the white races, or any race, any ethno-nationalist group, but established first for the white races to set the example and standard for others. To fulfill the race-specific mythogen is the grounding act of social responsibility and the sole truly universal moral duty. So there you have it, coming out of the gates. You can take that as a definition of ideosophy, but I think you can easily see as well that it is a mission statement. There is a particular mission, there is a particular engagement, a commitment associated with ideosophy. It is meant to be actional. And I do my best to make that clear from the outset. Now, if you care to take a moment and read carefully into the language of the statement, you'll find that I have addressed the problem existing today due to the fact that one particular racial group on the planet operates faithfully and relentlessly from their mythogen, and that there is no competing mythogen at the moment. One of the features of that mythogen, of that ethnic group, hey, let's call them the Eskimites. That would be fun. I'm going to call them the Eskimites in this talk, and maybe, who knows, it'll catch on. One of the features, one of the component factors of the mythogen of the Eskimites, who are on the one hand the most persecuted ethnic group in the world and on the other the most powerful, rich, and dominant, is the self-identification as a paragon. The Eskimites identify their racial group as a paragon, meaning a leading example. So their sacred scriptures make it plain, the language is very, very clear, that the nation and race of the Eskimites would stand as a shining beacon, setting the highest example of moral purity and obedience to God that could possibly be achieved. And they actually believe this, regardless of whether they adhere to certain of the religious components, strictly religious components in their mythogen. They still regard themselves as a unique race, standing as the paragon of all the best that the human race can be, to the extent that they still associate themselves with the human race and do not place themselves on the level of an Elohistic, angelic, or superhuman species, which has been known to happen. So there you go. If you read closely into the exact syntax I'm using, you'll see that I challenge that paragon, set by the Eskimites, according to their mythogen, with another mythogen, established first for the white races to set the example and standard for others. So I'm saying, really, and you can quote me on this, I stand for the power of the white races to be the paragon ethnic group and to oppose and overthrow the competing group, which currently has reached a terrifying level of control and influence in the modern world. So you will begin to know, you will begin to familiarize yourself, some of you already have, with the language and syntax that I use specific to this discourse about the races, the race romantic ethos, and the mythogen. There is a particular battery of words that go into that discourse and power that discourse, and I'm going to use them rigorously in this course. Also, you'll see here that I introduced the term moral imagination. I don't believe that I have actually spoken of that before. Again, this is a term that's been floating around for a while. It may be a term that is characteristic of certain known philosophers or sociologists. I don't know. I haven't looked into it. But I'm going to put my stamp on it, give it my spin, and hand it over to you as a powerful tool for the study and application of ideosophy. You will also note there, or I bring to your attention, the way that I have thrown in, just for seasoning, a term from the jargon of existentialism, engagement, which means just what it says, engagement, identical with commitment. Especially, it means a commitment to the moral and social conditions of your times. Now, it's quite likely that I'll dedicate at least one unit to existentialism, with a capital X, so that I can save you a shitload of trouble regarding that topic and save you an enormous waste of time. I can tell you what to read in existentialism, what not to read. I can tell you what's unreadable. And I can also tell you something that I learned, which really delighted me, something that I came to understand, which really delighted me after my initial hit of existentialism, which came when I was 16 and studying French in high school, thanks to my French teacher, Roberta Kimball, whose daughter, Nicole, was studying French at the university level, University of Maine, I don't know, perhaps. And Nicole came in as a guest to the French class one year, would have been a sophomore or junior, or it would have been the junior or senior year. And the subject of existentialism came up, existentialisme, les existentialistes. And I was completely zappoed on that. I mean, I just couldn't get enough of it. So then, after many years of floundering around in existentialism, I came to the happy realization that the entirety of that system can be stated adequately and accurately in about 5 clichés. And once you get those clichés and can use them comfortably, and they're easy to use, you can chuck all the rest of it down the drain. Somewhere along the way, quite early in my teaching career, I made the outrageous statement that existentialism was the expression of bodhisattva wisdom in the 20th century. Now, there's a great deal in a great deal of thought, a great deal of words, a great deal of rhetoric, a great deal of insufferable philosophical and quasi-psychological mishmash in existentialism that doesn't meet that standard. But I can tell you with pleasure that I stand by that standard. Yes, there are in existentialism some key elements to the bodhisattva wisdom of the 20th century and now the 21st century. And those elements, which are encapsulated in clichés such as engagement, hell is other people, le regard, the look, nausea, those elements that are encapsulated in those slang terms do carry, amazingly, do carry a sense of the bodhisattva wisdom in our time. So yeah, existentialism most definitely deserves a unit or two of its own to be posted in the curriculum for ideosophy. So fine. What else can I say to get ideosophy up and running in your minds? Well, as you can see, the course landing page is mercilessly brief. And it speaks for itself, really. It doesn't require elaboration or explanation. I note that I define ideosophy by what it stands against as well as by what it stands for. And it most certainly does stand against, first, the freestanding individual entitled to pursue selfish goals. That's the liberal concept of the individual. And second, equally, it stands against the idea of a universal humanity in which all members share common rights and interests. And I point out that in that dynamic, the assumption of equality is basic, but it contradicts itself because the liberal standard of freedom, which allows for all individuals to be different, defining themselves on solipsistic terms, does not go along with the collective universalist mindset. So there's an inherent contradiction that corrupts both notions, the notion of the individual and the notion of the collective. They are both corrupted and they corrupt each other. And I think it would be fair to say that that spectacle of corruption is massively evident in the world today and in current affairs and current events everywhere you look, in every direction, 24/7. The center cannot hold in that supposed balance. Thus, it generates a black hole of moral instability that sucks in and annihilates all genuine and sustainable standards of morality. Of course, I'm using black hole there simply as a metaphoric device. There is no such thing in the physics of the universe as a black hole. So I devote some time to framing, and I explain how the curriculum is divided into two parts. First, you get talking points, such as moral imagination, the race romantic commitment, the Gnostic adversary, and so forth. And then you get the units that are posted by sets. Set one, the divine experiment. Set two, the non plus ultra, and so on. And so what happens with the sets is that they frame the ideosophy, they frame the material in a particular way using the aphoristic method, as I explained. So there you go. I happily display a delicious picture of enchiladas with green and red sauce. So is the green the humanities and the red the ideosophy? Yeah, I would say so. There you go. And you've got a huge serving of those two sauces in Nemata. So I go on to explain the curriculum, the use of maxims, or short aphoristic sayings. And then I conclude with returning you to the issue of my standard. Now, I don't know if I've spoken of my standard to the guests and visitors at Nemata. I believe I made the, what do you call it, the definitive statement about my standard in one of the talks in 17 or 18, the Turton and the Terma or Breaking News. So it's auspicious that on this occasion of opening this course, I am able to state my standard to guests and visitors as well, if they don't know what it is already. And to set you up for that message, I've included here this rather remarkable image. Can you imagine sculpting those curls out of marble? Is it even possible? Anyway, there you have a profile of a classical maternal figure from Greek or Roman culture. Well, she could equally be from the Levant, you know. Sophianic myth emerged from the Levant, and the main population of the Levant at the time it developed and up until the high point of the mysteries would have been Persians, people of the Persian ethnic stock, which is Aryan. So anyway, that face I propose to you, I suggest, assumes the look of a Greek or Roman matron. It is not strictly correct to imagine the face and figure of the wisdom goddess anthropomorphically after the human form. In her state of material immanence as the living planet, it is inevitable to do so, however. In her primary state of aeonic luminosity, not so. The organic light cannot be reduced to any anthropomorphic visualization, but it has to be said that anthropomorphic and theriomorphic features play through it like massive weather fronts pulsing in the atmosphere. The aeon projects these features into the human psyche to facilitate recognition of her presence. And as I've showed in other units, one of the most well-known surviving examples of projecting the image of the wisdom goddess and even of the organic light into human form is the Diana of Ephesus, featured with many breasts. Can truly be said that anthropomorphic or human resembling images of the Aeonic Mother arise as intra-psychic projections coming from her, rather than from the human witness commonly assumed to generate those images. Once they are seen, or usually merely glimpsed, what the mother has projected into the psyche of her pet species comes to be regarded as the product of the species. Well, naturally. Thus it was that once on Infinity Ridge, the Nawal saw in the sky the image of the Aeon Sophia resembling the face of a Roman matron, a maternal Athena, or Minerva. And the thought came instantly, Yes, she has often been pictured like that. As soft, molten marble, curling locks and all. This image of a human face in classical style with white Aryan nobility might be the appropriate visualization to hold in mind as you delve into the material of Course 12, if you care to do so. Picture the mother beholding you in this way, if you like. It cannot be harmful or misleading. And contemplate that face beholding you as you recall the standard of this work. It originates as my standard, and now it is also your standard. To describe and demonstrate the operations of human imagination coupled with divine imagination. The Course in Ideosophy is your commitment to uphold that standard and bring it to life.